Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Mota. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. Discussions are built on slow reading and attentiveness to ideas. You can tune in wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. You can receive updates by following me on Blue Sky or LinkedIn. What you're hearing in the background there is the sound of a Geiger counter registering radiation at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactor exclusion zone, which I had the good fortune of visiting in early February 2026. I traveled to Fukushima with Jason Waite, who lectures in the history of art at St. Anne's College, Oxford, and Qingpeng artist Motumo. They are both part of a collaboratively developed art project called Don't Follow the Wind, which is a long-term engagement with the destruction and catastrophe that is the Fukushima disaster. It was developed by Qingpeng, Kenji Kubota, Eva and Franco Mattes, and Jason Waite. I have called this episode Fukushima, the art of staying with the trouble, drawing there from Donna Haraway's famous phrase, because Don't Follow the Wind is in multiple ways an exercise of examining the durational character of the nuclear disaster, but also what it means for a community and society to develop long-standing associations and responses to this kind of catastrophe. Among the many things I learned from my visit to Fukushima is that the nuclear disaster is part of a much longer history of extraction and exploitation of the Fukushima region. And at a time when we're grappling with climate catastrophes and biodiversity destruction, Fukushima and the Don't Follow the Wind project holds many lessons about the nature and implications of extractive relations, as well as what it means to live with more than human life, which has now started to return and proliferate in the Fukushima region. My conversation with Jason Waite took place over 2 days and in more than one location. So I am merging different recordings, some of which were made on site in the locations where art is installed and exhibited, albeit art that is currently inaccessible to the general public. Jason Waite, welcome to Countersign. I've just spent the last 2 days with you in Fukushima Prefecture in Japan. Where are we in Fukushima? Let's just describe a little bit of what's going on. We're in a restaurant and there's a bit of noise around.
Yes. We're in a cafe in Tomioka, which is about 4 hours drive north of Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And Tomioka is one of the places that was evacuated after the nuclear disaster that began in 2011.
So there's a little bit of background noise. We've just had a ramen noodle, and we're trying to stay warm because it's really cold outside. Let's start, because not everyone knows the details about the earthquake in 2011. The tsunami and the ensuing meltdown of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactors. So tell us something about that.
Yeah, March 11, 2011, there was a 9.0 earthquake that happened just off the northern coast in Japan. And that earthquake destroyed a lot of infrastructure in the area. And then half hour later, a large tsunami with waves over 15 meters came and hit the northern coast of Japan. And on the northern coast, there are a number of different nuclear power plants. And one of them is the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, located in Fukushima Prefecture. But it's owned, actually, by Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO. And all of the power generated by Fukushima Daiichi was actually sent down to Tokyo, so it didn't service any of the local community. On March 11th, the earthquake disrupted the power plant. The reactor scrammed and shut down. But importantly, the power lines going into the nuclear power plant were severed. And this is kind of underknown, that nuclear power plants don't actually function by themselves, that they mm-hmm. need external power generation.
Yes.
And so they lost external power, and then the backup generators in the basement came on. However, with the tsunami that occurred a half hour later, this flooded the generators and cut out all power to the plant. And over the next couple days, three of the six reactors ended up melting down and radiation escaped their containment units. So what this meant is that radiation flowed into the Pacific Ocean mm-hmm. Next to the nuclear power plant and went up into the atmosphere. There was a series of hydrogen explosions which blew apart the external containment units and then aerated the radioactive nucleides. These radioactive nucleides went all over the planet, but particularly they followed the wind currents.
Okay.
And the wind currents, thankfully, were largely blowing offshore for most of the time, but they also blew inland and blew across Fukushima Prefecture and in and around northern Japan. So what happened in the wake of the disaster is there was a 20-kilometer evacuation zone. So where we're sitting now was evacuated for the first year of the disaster. And then the government tested the areas within the 20 kilometers for radiation and found a 320-kilometer zone, which is commonly called the Fukushima Exclusion Zone.
320 square kilometer zone.
Square kilometers, yeah. So it's about the size of Glasgow.
Right.
Or so.
And so this was the space that was effectively subject to radiation. And it was plutonium and cesium-137 that was the radioactive nuclides that contaminated the area. Is that right?
So actually, the radiation went all over not only the north of Japan, but also down to Tokyo and Chiba. So right. It was quite widespread. But actually, the greatest concentration of radionuclides were in this area. However, the surrounding areas, where also we were, also had this radiation and displaced people for a number of years.
The location of the nuclear reactors, significant thing I had sort of read in your various works on this was that in the construction of the nuclear plant, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, had removed a ridge that would have otherwise protected the area from the tsunami. And so in a sense, And they did this because it was economical for construction and for future supply of the plant. So there was a sense in which this is, people refer to it often as a natural disaster, but it was in many ways a man-made disaster.
That's right. And both the independent report as well as the government report both determined that this was a human-made disaster, and this is very important. Mm-hmm. And part of the conditions were, as you described, I mentioned that the plant was owned and built by TEPCO, by Tokyo Electric. And it was built in the post-war period. Fukushima, before the war, was a large coal-producing area. And by the 1950s, coal became economically infeasible to produce in Japan. And so in kind of looking for a future economy, they continued a kind of energy extractivism by inviting in nuclear power plants to Fukushima.
So you're an art curator. You've written a PhD in relation to Fukushima and the work of artists in response.
That's right.
To the nuclear disaster. What first brought you here?
Personally, I have spent a lot of time in East Asia and Southeast Asia, but I had never been to Japan before the disaster. Mm-hmm. And actually, what brought me here was in part hurricane in New York City, where I'm from, Hurricane Sandy, that happened in October 2012. And Hurricane Sandy was a real shocking experience. Personally, living in New York, and my family's from New York, and had never seen the city inundated by water. Half of Manhattan lost power. And within this disaster, Hurricane Sandy occurred about 1 year after the Occupy movement. And what was very fascinating is while the state and federal government were very slow to respond, the networks from Occupy sprung up once again and started to organize relief efforts between citizens themselves. And so I was a part of some of these relief efforts, and it was really fascinating to see how citizens could address large-scale natural disaster. And moreover, within that disaster, there were experiments of how to perhaps refashion society in the wake of such an occurrence.
Mm-hmm. We're thinking about these comparisons of catastrophes and disasters right now in the context of climate change and so on. And part of what you drew, I think, from the experience you just described in relation to Hurricane Sandy is to point to the failures of the state in its response and how citizens and communities come together to respond, to offer mutual support. And having spent the last 2 days talking to you and having looked at the project Don't Follow the Wind, the sense I get is that artists have been really significant in their response to the disaster, but also in helping communities to come together. So what did you encounter when you first came to Fukushima in 2013?
I met Chimpom in New York. Chimpom's a collective of artists based in Tokyo, and they had done a lot of work in Fukushima immediately after the disaster in 2011.
So to say a little bit more about Chimpom.
Chimpom's a collective of artists that all come from really alternative backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And they joined together in around 2010, and had done a number of projects where they engaged their own bodies, kind of really coming from a lower class backgrounds. They saw themselves as material that could be used, and kind of growing up on the streets in Shinjuku and areas, they really
in Tokyo,
they really engaged with street culture and their experience of engaging in what is kind of a hyper-capitalism of Tokyo in the late 20th century, and attempting to kind of play around with that, with both humor and critique.
Mm-hmm. And Chimpom had come to Fukushima soon after the disaster, right? So they were, in a sense, amongst the first artists and activists to bear witness to what was happening.
Chimpom was really interested in working long-term in the area. While they had done a number of projects that were interventions, they wanted to do something that could work on the timescale of a nuclear disaster. And we started talking about what it would mean to have an exhibition inside this closed zone, inside the Fukushima exclusion zone, and how art perhaps has a unique capacity, a durational capacity, to contest disaster. When we go to certain museums, we can see pottery and objects that have existed for tens of thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And this can be on the same horizon as some of the nuclear elements. You were talking about plutonium and cesium and uranium and the like. Mm-hmm. So we started to think about how art could respond to a disaster. But around thinking about disaster and thinking around nuclear disaster, there's this notion of spectacle that looms quite large. Mm-hmm. And if a project is to work on the time horizon of disaster, how could it continually function? How could an exhibition continually have purchase and urgency? And for us, the notion of spectacle was quite limited.
So by spectacle here, you mean a kind of like a monumentalized or a monumental response? Like an artwork that monumentalizes a disaster. And that's not what Chimpom are doing.
Yeah. In a way, it was thinking that we're coming into a situation that itself is already a spectacle.
Right.
So attempting to try to create a project that harnessed or tried to accelerate spectacle just didn't have a real interest. In fact, it was working quite antithetically to the social, cultural, and political work that was needed over the long term, mm-hmm, to both contest and then to rebuild after a nuclear disaster. And so when we were thinking about a project, we thought, well, what if we invited artists to create an exhibition that was inside the zone? But as radiation can't be seen, what if the exhibition itself couldn't be seen too?
Right.
So what does the sense of rumor or what are other alternative knowledge sharing strategies that can perhaps filter through over the long term? And how can a project maintain relevancy and also maintain itself as a mnemonic, as a memory device that's constantly activating not only those in the area, but also elsewhere, to continually focus on what actually a long-term nuclear disaster means?
Mm-hmm. So it's an exhibition that can't be seen in the usual way. You know, it's not something that the public can simply go and visit in large numbers, but you and I visited two of the sites over the last 2 days. And so there's this temporal dimension that you mentioned earlier, that you're mirroring the duration of radiation itself by situating artwork within the site that can't currently be accessed. So say a little bit more about this notion of don't follow the wind. Where does the title come from?
The title came from an experience of one of the collaborating residents on the project. So initially, after kind of the desire to collaborate and to do this project, we also invited Kenji Kubota, who's an independent curator based in Tokyo, mm-hmm, and Ava and Franco Mates, who are two Italian artists based in New York. And as a collective, we started to spend time in Fukushima meeting residents who were displaced in the area around, and finding people who also had a desire to think and act in a different way around the disaster. And we found a community that invited us into their displaced homes in the zone. In particular, we were drawn to the story of one individual. And on March 11, 2011, he lived 2 kilometers away from the nuclear power plant. And he got a call that day from his friend who worked inside the Fukushima Daiichi power plant. And the friend said that the situation in the plant is much worse than the media and government are saying, and you should evacuate with your family immediately. So he got into his car, with his family, and they started driving north. But he happened to be a hobby fisherman and sailor, so he knew how the winds worked. And he stopped his car and he got out, and he realized that he was driving towards where the wind was carrying the majority of the radionuclides. So he turned his car south and drove him and his family to relative safety. And that was important to us for a number of different reasons. This sense of friendship or rumor that and alternative knowledge sharing networks that can come in the face of disaster really showed us that perhaps even an exhibition can speak or work in a very different way. These ordinary aspects could become extraordinary in times of crisis. And for us as artists and cultural workers, we also had to work in a very different way to respond to such a unique crisis.
And so you and Shimpom and the other curators have gathered works of art that have been installed and placed in homes, in a farm that we visited yesterday, that at least for the time being can't be accessed.
There are 12 artist projects. We invited 12 artists to create new commissions inside the zone that were installed inside the zone. And so the artists include Ai Weiwei and Trevor Paglin, Meira Koizumi, Chimpom, Ahmed Oot, and others. And artists created these works, and then the exhibition opened on the fourth anniversary, on March 11, 2015.
Right.
It opened, but it couldn't be seen.
Okay.
And so a website was launched on that day. But counterintuitively, the website didn't have descriptions of the work and photographs and this, but instead the website was a blank page with one collective audio track. Mm-hmm. And this was an English-Japanese of the artist and curators speaking about the project over 3 minutes. And again, kind of utilizing the tools of the disaster to try to counter the disaster. So thinking about rumor, thinking about oral history, thinking about embodied histories that can perhaps be passed on and contest also this durational disaster.
The segment that follows was recorded at a farm in the Fukushima exclusion zone. And in the course of our conversation, we cover the nature of remediation, that is the activities undertaken by the Japanese government to remove as much irradiated material, grass, brush as possible, and where the residents wish that the government do so, they would also remove various buildings. So we discuss that process of remediation, as well as the art that is installed at the site and the manner in which more than human life has been returning and manifesting their presence within this zone.
So how does radiation behave in a site like this over time?
There's three types of radiation. There's alpha, beta, and there's gamma radiation. The alpha and beta radiation works on the human body only in very close proximity. And it's very potent, but it needs to be ingested or inside the body to really have an effect. Gamma radiation moves through us, and gamma radiation can't be stopped except through lead or very or concrete, kind of thick wall of concrete. And so these Tyvek suits that we're wearing, what this is actually doing, the suit are not protecting us per se. The alpha and beta particles land on the suit, and then we will take off the suits when we leave the zone and give the suits to the government. The government then incinerates the suits, mixes them with the ash with concrete, and installs these concrete blocks in a temporary storage facility in Fukushima. Mm-hmm. And so the suits themselves are making sure that the radiation actually stays within Fukushima itself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we don't carry it out on our clothes, carry it out on our body, outside of the zone.
And a site like this, and I, as I can observe, has sort of fresh soil here and fresh gravel. So this is all part of the remediation program. So layers of soil have been removed and new soil has been deposited. Is that right?
That's right. The farm has undergone a remediation process that's taken about a year. Mm-hmm. And contractors have come in and cleared all of the grass and the brush and flat areas and removed the top 10 centimeters of soil. And then all of that is placed into big black plastic bags, which mm-hmm. we see.
We saw as we drove in, yeah.
That's right, we see in the surrounding countryside. These black plastic bags are then taken, incinerated by the government. The ash is mixed with concrete and then placed in temporary storage facilities here in Fukushima. This is all for low-level radioactive waste.
Yeah. And what about the large trees? So they're obviously, you know, they're being left in place, but things the brush underneath and the soil underneath has been remediated.
That's right. So what we see around us is the only adult trees that are remaining. And over to the right, we can see a forested area, and this is slightly different. What you'll notice in the forested area is that all of the trees remain younger and older trees, mm-hmm. but the ground is still the ground that was there before.
Right.
And so it's the brush underneath mm-hmm. that has been picked away. So all of the bushes, all of the grass has been cleared, and then any fallen leaves in this have been collected. These have all been put in bags and then go through the same process of incineration and temporary storage. So we're looking at family home on the farm that was built in the early 2000s. Uh-huh. And quite extraordinarily, it looks quite clean.
Yeah,
it looks in very good shape.
Yeah, I mean, it almost looks like it's, you know, far, far newer than that. But that's because it's been washed and cleaned. And so more recent visitors to the farm have been of a non-human kind.
Yes. And this artist studio in particular uh-huh. is where we first found out that there were a more than human community that was quite thriving in the area.
Yeah.
And perhaps we can go take a look at it right now.
Yeah. We've got the Geiger counter keeping us company, keeping time.
Yeah. So the farm is remediated, but it's not finished. There's a two-step process.
Yeah.
One is the cleaning of the landscape, and then after that's finished, there's a second group of contractors that comes in that do the demolition. Mm-hmm. So we're just walking by a chicken shack here that is a very poor state after the earthquake. And so this chicken shack will be demolished, but the majority of structures on the farm will remain. So you can see we're looking at a small wooden hut that's about 2.5 meters wide and 3 or 4 meters in depth, small one-story structure. And you can see that the front door has a large dent.
Yeah, it's a metal door with almost sort of 20% of it looking like it's smashed in at the bottom.
Yeah, it looks like a car ran into the door. And I come to the zone with a collective about every 3 months or so. And on one of these occasions, soon after the project started, we found the door in this state. But it actually wasn't shut. It was wide open with this huge dent in it. And the contents of the hut were scattered all in front. And we're opening the door. Mm-hmm. And you can see inside, there's a few paintings that are resting against the wall. Mm-hmm. There's a chair. There's a fan that's somewhat rusted and
lying on its side. Yeah.
And the door is broken open, and we were really shocked because there's no humans that are in the area. And we looked in, and we realized what you can see is that there's oil paints scattered mm-hmm. around because this used to be an artist studio.
There's some tubes of paint there. Was not many tubes. There's only two tubes, and there's paint on the floor, paint stains and
that's
paint
right.
markings. Yeah,
and you can see two or three crushed tubes.
Yeah.
And we realized that a wild boar had broken in to the studio, and they had crushed these tubes with their mouths and with their hooves, and then moved these tubes around, creating a very gestural painting on the floor of the artist studio.
Kind of hooved inscriptions on the floor.
And there's multiple colors as well. And so this kind of Boer's contribution to Don't Follow the Wind was a real turning point for us, because it was the first time that we realized that there's not only a kind of human element to the disaster, but there's also a huge more than human community that has been affected by the disaster or has moved in since mm-hmm. the disaster happened.
Mm-hmm. And is interacting with the buildings, the dwellings, the various materials that have been left behind here by humans. And the boars, you were telling me earlier, have also vastly increased in number, creating a whole set of questions about what the human and more than human interactions would be like when this area sees the return of more humans.
That's right. There was a survey done around 5 years after the disaster happened and found that the wild boar community has increased 500 times. And, you know, with this kind of large increase of wild boar, there's other creatures who have moved in for the first time. So mm-hmm. there's community of macaques that we've seen on the farm. Kamoshika, which are similar to a kind of a cross between a goat and a deer, that are known as the ghost of the forest. And they're largely solo animals that rarely have been seen. But actually, we were here last winter and saw one on the farm in person. And this was a shock, not only to us, but to our collaborators and friends who used to live here, because they had never seen Kamoshika in their life. Mm-hmm. So the composition of residents and more than human residents has drastically changed since the disaster. Here in Fukushima, it's very different than Chernobyl. In Chernobyl, people have been permanently evacuated and will not be moving back to the area. But yet the government is undertaking remediation efforts here in Fukushima with the hope that residents will return at mm-hmm. some point in time in the future. And so this potentially sets up a conflict between the returning human residents and this large, more than human community that mm-hmm. has grown up since the disaster.
And we were talking about this earlier, and you were using this example of the likely interaction of the human and more than human as a kind of corrective to notions of wilding and rewilding that people have been talking about. And you were saying that, you know, sometimes there's a sort of Arcadia or a sort of a kind of imagined state of nature that people have in the context of rewilding that doesn't see humans coexisting with the more than human. So, you know, how does Fukushima provide a different way to think about this?
Something that's been spoken a lot about Chernobyl and to some degree in Fukushima is this notion of rewilding, meaning when humans leave, then nature is allowed to return and mm-hmm. nature is allowed to flourish. But this flourishing is never coexistent with a human presence, is always considered and imagined in the absence of the human presence. And so this notion of rewilding or returning to a pure nature always is missing a kind of natural element, and that's us as humans. And so this imaginary is really fraught because it means that therefore we can't coexist with nature or we shouldn't coexist with nature on any terms, and that nature only flourishes without humans. And Fukushima is a very interesting case because residents will be returning to this area, which has been evacuated by a human residential presence for over the last decade. And so while this more than human community kind of has increased greatly, people will return, but they'll return in much smaller numbers than they were here before. What does it mean to actively live in a rewild area? What does it mean for humans to return to live and to coexist? And mm-hmm. I think Fukushima provides a really interesting case study for how we can renegotiate living together once again with the more than human community, with nature. So what types of built structures, for example, what type of interspecies infrastructure can help to facilitate this living? What are the ways and habits that we can live together? And this sense of rewilding also has the notion that this is new, for example. Mm-hmm. This sense of nature flourishing without humans has never existed before. But actually, when we talk to local residents, hunters and foresters who have been working in the forest here for decades and still in the surrounding areas are going back into the forest. And they say, you know, this isn't necessarily a novel situation. Actually, the amount of animals in the forest is closer to what it was like in the 1950s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And I think this is very important because it means that we don't necessarily have to find novel ways of living together, but perhaps we already have an archaeology of habits of coexisting with large mammals, mm-hmm. whether mm-hmm. those be bears or whether those be wild boars. Yeah. So how can we kind of return to this knowledge that perhaps has been forgotten? Or how can we reconstruct once again these ways of coexisting, which we have for many years and centuries? Mm. And so I think this structure, for example, that we're standing in front of is really fascinating because the wild boar broke in, and we were very concerned that this would happen again. And so we talked to researchers and scientists and boar specialists, and we asked them, you know, what do people do to protect from boars breaking into their structures? And a number of these scientists were really shocked to hear that there are boar breaking into homes because this doesn't normally happen in situations. So they had no answer and no suggestions for us. So one of our artist collaborators, he actually looked to the north to the indigenous Ainu people who live in Hokkaido. That's an island just north of the island that we're on now. And they have a lot of snow there, and so they've developed this system of blocking the doors so that snow doesn't break into one's homes. Mm-hmm. And so you can see here this very kind of...
It looks a very solid wooden structure.
Yeah, almost like a pallet. And so it's secured with a rope on either side.
Yeah.
And then bounded to two pieces of wood that have been screwed onto the front of the building to protect the house. And so this was common in northern areas when people would leave their homes for a period of time to protect the structure from snow or perhaps from other animals for coming into homes. So it's also very interesting... way of what does this already mean to coexist now as an exhibition? What does it mean to coexist with artworks and structures where we're not living constantly, but yet we would prefer to have perhaps a still right now, a slight separation mm-hmm. of spaces between the surrounding neighbors and the inhabitable spaces.
Also an interesting variation on what a gallery would usually look like, because we have this sort of sense of the gallery as an extremely minimalist space, one from which everything has been made absent apart from the artwork, and somehow curating artworks, you know, has this highly sanitized, I mean, not in every case, but, you know, if you walk into a gallery, usually... is extremely tidy and clean, and it's an extremely orderly space. And you're talking and thinking about a different kind of space for exhibiting artwork.
That's right. And looking into the hut just beyond the Boer painting, we can see a server that's connected to a solar panel on the roof.
Oh, right. Yeah, I was wondering what that... would look like something that's been put here more recently.
That's right. And this was installed by a New York-based artist, Taryn Simon, and as part of her project for Don't Follow the Wind called Final Photos. And she's asked residents to share their last photo that they took before the disaster happened. Mm-hmm. And these photos can be very banal. For example, photograph of a fire alarm on a ceiling taken by a resident who needed to document this in order to get reimbursed for the fire alarm from the local municipal council. And so these final photos are the last kind of mundane everyday photos before this rupture happened. And what she's thinking about is, what does it mean to kind of reinstall these photos in a place where the residents have been removed from? So while the residents can't be there, their photos and their memories can still exist in the place where they once lived. Hmm. And this archive of photographs is actually available on the website finalphotos.com. Mm-hmm. And the server for these photos is here, what we're looking at right now.
Wow.
So while the residents can't be here, they can access them online, and the original photos themselves are residing back in the place where they can no longer be.
Yeah, they're on site here in Fukushima in this extremely high-tech looking box, but the box itself is contained within a far more modest looking wooden structure, which is a space that the wild boar visited and made their own artwork.
Following this incredibly visceral account of the present in Fukushima, in the next segment, Jason and I discuss the history of the indigenous peoples of Fukushima being absorbed into the Japanese Empire during the course of a long process of colonization, which of course resonates with colonialism and extractive practices in many other regions of the world. And we then move to consider how this links up with different notions of sovereignty and the notion of radiation itself that TEPCO and others have asserted to be masterless. And then we close with a discussion of the prefigurative, the various anti-capitalist practices of coming together and forming and reforming community.
To go back to the notion of a durational disaster, one of the things I didn't know until I started reading your doctoral thesis is that the extraction of Fukushima that was taking place because a nuclear reactor was located there, but the electricity was being used in Tokyo, was actually, you know, it was a present manifestation of something that had been taking place for a very long time, that there was an internal colonization of Fukushima by imperial powers from the south. Tell us a little bit about that.
Fukushima is on the northern part of Honshu Island, in the center of Japan, main island. And this area north of Tokyo together is called Tohoku. And Tohoku had largely been an autonomous area with its own indigenous people who called themselves the Mishi.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the 8th century?
Yeah, we're talking about exactly the 6th, 7th, 8th century.
Yeah.
And the Japanese Empire in Nara wanted to conquest the north. And so spent a campaign of 150 years to kind of take over the north of Japan. This is also why I think...
It's a kind of where the durational comes in.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, this is a, you know, much longer project of destabilization of communities. And it's also where I feel very conflicted because using the term internal colonization is a real shorthand in the age of the nation state to understand how areas can have their own identities, economies, cultures, and be subsumed into larger power forces and larger dominant cultures. However, in the case of Fukushima, I really want to argue that it's colonization itself that was occurring. And this is really extending the temporal bounds back to the 7th and 8th century, when there was separate indigenous people here, and the ways of living and working were very different than elsewhere in Japan.
And so the Emeshi, the indigenous people of this region in Fukushima, they and it's an undulating landscape. It's mountainous. There were horsemen. They had curved swords, and these were techniques that started to be appropriated by imperial powers in the south. So, you know, we, you know, ordinarily, colloquially, have a knowledge about the samurai and the shogun as a kind of militaristic warlord. But these were actually techniques and manifestations of a far more ancient culture that had been appropriated by the imperial forces. So that it's in that sense also that there was an extraction of culture and materials from the north by the south.
Yeah, so actually the position of the shogun, who is a military leader, was created for the unique purpose of conquering Tohoku. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the shogun becomes the kind of dominant figure in Edo period in Tokugawa Japan, who runs the country as the emperor is sidelined. And so this comes from the war with the indigenous people of Fukushima. But secondarily, the empire was using Chinese military techniques, kind of Tang Dynasty, very heavy bronze armor, which was on both infantry soldiers and also on horseback riders. And this was meant to fight on the plains. So, right. Large battle formations that would move forward in sync. But in this mountainous terrain, as you described, the Amishi people rode horses. They used bows and arrows from horseback. They could ride and shoot at the same time. These were all skills that the Imperial Army didn't have. And so in the first campaign to come up in the 600s, the Imperial forces were just slaughtered, just picked off as they moved up in these very clunky formations. And actually, the emperor had to hire 3,000 Imishi to come down and train the Imperial forces in ways of more flexible, more perhaps guerrilla warfare. And so what they did is they brought down these techniques of not only riding horses, but changing armor where it's more flexible, where one can move. They taught the soldiers how to shoot from horsebacks. And then also, when you ride with horsebacks, having these kind of straight, heavy bronze swords don't function as well. So a kind of more curved sword was developed. And this is, as you were mentioning, was the kind of the basements of the samurai figure that we see today. About 50% of the samurai figure actually comes from Imishi people. And I think this story is not only important to think about the colonial aspect of Fukushima, but it's also important to think about the homogeneous mythology around Japan itself.
Right.
So what's embodied in this story is actually not Japan as a singular concept, as a singular people, but there's multiple ethnicities, multiple peoples fighting on the island of Japan itself. And it also shows that Japanese traditions were influenced deeply by others. And so when we think about, for example, contemporary migration in Japan and the need for migrant workers, and what does it mean for Japan moving forward with a declining population? Mm-hmm. How can Japan reimagine itself as a country that's perhaps more open to surrounding countries and to others? You know, it tries to lay the groundwork for pulling apart this mythology that there's one people and one bloodline in Japan as well.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, we've just been talking really about the constitution of a certain type of sovereignty, the imagination of Japan as a unitary state, as a unitary formation, and that actually the reality is far more complex, that there's this internal colonization that has taken place. But to bring this back to the nuclear disaster, radiation itself has been spoken about as its own master. And that's happened in order for TEPCO and the state to distance themselves from responsibility for radiation. So where did that reference to radiation being its own master come from?
So the theorist Sabu Koso, in his latest book from Duke, Radiation Revolution, talks about TEPCO, the power company, in the wake of the disaster.
They were the ones who were running the nuclear plant.
The nuclear power plant, had claimed that radiation, once it escaped the plant, was a so-called masterless object, that they had not only no control over it, but also no responsibility for it. And this is very interesting when thinking about sovereignty in connection to radiation. What I argue instead is, wherever the radiation landed, actually TEPCO bared responsibility for the welfare of those who were displaced. So where the radionuclides landed in the largest concentration forced populations out, and TEPCO, unlike the local government, TEPCO then became responsible for the welfare of these citizens. So thinking about pollution as contingent on sovereignty is a really fascinating connection that I think also helps us to understand this new nuclear landscape in a really different way.
Yeah, I mean, the radiation as a massless object is an extraordinary kind of distortion of the way in which, you know, sort of object-oriented ontologists have talked about things having their own agency. And you can see how various manifestations of critical theory can also be morphed and adapted by really pernicious forces. So it's, as you say, not a masterless object. It is very much a human creation and requires responsibility to be taken by humans. And I think this takes us to a wider set of concerns and issues, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about that. We discussed the difference between critique as a kind of work that looks at structures and systems, and in contrast to this, how you see prefigurative practices adopted and distributed by artists. So let's talk a little bit about that difference between doing sort of large-scale critique and the prefigurative work of artists. Because one of the responses you often hear from theorists and jurists and so on is, well, you know, we're talking about real-world problems. How can art respond to a nuclear catastrophe? And, of course, what I've witnessed over the last few days is precisely that response. But the response happens in this contested terrain of knowledge production as well.
The prefigurative, I return to Gibson and Graham, who are a feminist theorist writing duo, and they talk about the prefigurative in the context of capitalism, and they see the social as an iceberg, wherein at the very tip of the iceberg above the water is labor, the stock market, the knowledge economy, and what can be seen commodified. And then under the iceberg is the affective labor, the taking care of children, the environment, all of those forms that are both substructures but also much larger than the than that tip of the iceberg. And so they think about the prefigurative as creating an anti-capitalist future or a post-capitalist future now in the present. So what they're contesting is, to some degree, Hart and Negri's empire and the notion of capitalism is everywhere and we are already within it and is within us and there is nothing we can do.
So just for people not so familiar with Hart and Negri's Empire, this is a book that comes out in around 2000, published by Harvard University Press. Attracts a lot of attention, and they are basically talking about a new concept of sovereignty, which they express as empire, and influenced by Deleuze and Guattari, they suggest that there is no outside of empire, that empire arises out of immanent forces within it. They refer to the multitude. So it is all forms of manifestations of capital, as well as the desires of individuals and communities that are involved in processes of production and consumption. And the prefigurative that you're talking about is that there are other layers that is both outside and inside these formations.
That's right. So this notion of kind of there is no outside, therefore everything we do is not only shaped by capitalism, but everything we do is to some degree capitalist in origin or effect, let's say. And this is a very important distinction that Graham and Gibson make, where they argue that there is an outside, there is a way of working differently, and not only can you do that, but it's necessitated in order to move past capitalism. So how can we come up with alternative forms of social structures, or how can we extend already existing social structures that are not conditioned by capitalism, are not conditioned per se by the state, to think and enact and experiment already in the present to make the future that we want now.
Mm-hmm. So to bring it back to Fukushima. Yesterday, we visited a farm. How does that manifestation of the inaccessible exhibition, how does that connect to this thinking on the prefigurative and sort of future resistant communities or communities that are resisting now, I suppose? And what kind of concrete practices, relationships of mutual support and obligation does that sort of site of the farm manifest?
Yeah, behind the exhibition itself is the curatorial collective of artists and cultural workers who are both based here in Japan and based elsewhere. So what does it mean to work together in a certain site? What does it mean to work across languages, across borders? And then there's also a community of artists involved in the project that have given their time and energy and engaged with not only the land and ecology, but also with the displaced residents. Mm-hmm. And then there's a committee of cultural workers largely based in Tokyo and Fukushima that also support the project. And so there are these kind of many different social layers that then dovetail with the residents who are presently displaced, but who might be returning in the future. So how to think about an exhibition not only as a composition of objects in space, but also as diverse social compositions that are entangled in and around the project and that are involved in the land, and the residents, and potentially in helping to shape and form the future of this area. And this is very important because Fukushima is quite different than Chernobyl. Chernobyl, the nuclear disaster there, the USSR permanently displaced large populations who might never return. And in Fukushima, while there's been a large displacement of people, there's tens of thousands of people who are displaced for the last 15 years and still today, the government has undertaken remediation efforts, or so-called cleanup efforts, to attempt to return the land to a livable condition in low-level radiation. While this is contested, it's certainly a different approach to a nuclear disaster. And so this will be the first time where an area will be remediated, and then the population has the decision to move back or not.
So this is an incredible site for thinking about a problem that crisscrosses multiple disasters. So when we're thinking about living in this time of climate destruction, the future involves living in a catastrophe. And it seems to me that what this project in Fukushima points to is that people do live with and work within the crisis. They find and devise strategies, as I was saying earlier, to provide support, to share resources, to think about distributions of land and wealth differently. And it also gives rise to new and different forms of political subjectivities. So you've referred, you know, multiple times to Shimpom as a collective. It's a it's an artist collective, and all of their works are created together. It's not a, it's not one individual artist's work. Amateur Riot is also a group that you've written about. Again, a collective that is helping to devise new political horizons. So could you say a little bit about what those horizons are? Because there's a real sort of sense in which, and this is the surreal aspect of coming to Fukushima for me, is that I didn't expect actually to be finding strategies for the future here. I mean, because looking at it from outside, you're coming to the site of a nuclear disaster. It's you're sort of slightly expecting to find something apocalyptic, something dystopian, And actually, it's quite the opposite that I've been encountering over the last few days.
And I think one of the futures and presents that we have to negotiate, we've found in the project, is how to rethink coexistence with our more than human neighbors. Mm-hmm. And we were on the farm and we saw this intervention by a wild boar into the project of mm-hmm. Don't Follow the Wind. And this, for the first time, raised awareness for us in the project that, you know, there's not only a human dimension to this disaster, but there's also a more than human dimension. And this more than human dimension is growing in urgency as this population is expanding.
So what lies ahead for Don't Follow the Wind?
Don't Follow the Wind is going through a big transition. The project has been going on since 2015 when it opened, and we're sitting in 2026, so it's been 11 years. Mm-hmm. And the government is attempting to remediate, as I mentioned, and allow residents to return home. So two of the major sites of Don't Follow the Wind are undergoing remediation, and majority of...
So just say a little bit more about remediation. What is it actually concretely and materially involved?
Remediation is quite interesting. We can speak maybe first just about the imaginary of what it would mean to remove radiation from the landscape,
yes.
Right? Because this is, you know, in order to remove radiation from the landscape, that would mean taking away all of the trees, shrubs, houses, and the top layer of soil, and then completely having a very dystopian terra nova. Mm-hmm. And instead, what the government is doing is they're doing this in small-scale pockets. So, for example, the farm that we were at yesterday is in the process of being remediated.
So remediation is taking place, and we were talking about the immediate future for Don't Follow the Wind, which is going to be transitioning.
And so with this process of remediation, this means that a number of sites of Don't Follow the Wind will now be accessible in 2028,
right.
Likely opening on March 11th, 2028 for 1 year. But, you know, the project was intended to be opened when residents can return and when the area has become safe again. And the reality on the ground is quite complex. Areas are being remediated, but low-level radiation remains. Mm-hmm. Residents are invited back, but not all are returning. A lot of the local infrastructure has been destroyed. So what does it mean to open an art exhibition that's been waiting to be seen? And what does it mean to actually invite visitors into these areas? They're all discussions that we're presently having and attempting to negotiate.
Well, Jason, it's been an extraordinary experience for me to come to Fukushima with you. It presents, I think, an extraordinary opportunity to really think about the future. And I would really cherish the opportunity to return at some point, perhaps in 2028, when the exhibition is more accessible and it opens. But I think part of what Don't Follow the Wind and you as a curator and various artists have made possible is that we don't think about catastrophe as an event, as a singular event. It is a phenomenon that has duration that reaches backwards in time to think about extractive and colonial pasts and extractive and colonial futures, but also to think about the alternative possibilities of community collaboration and resistance. So I've learned a huge amount in coming here with you, in talking to you over the last couple of days. So I'm really grateful for this, and thanks so much for coming on Countersign.
Thank you, my pleasure.
You have been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.